Hello, welcome to Healthy Disruptions, a podcast about health and health inequities across our diverse communities in Southern California.
In this podcast, we speak with community members, students, researchers, and leadership to bring you the real experts on health disparities.
Join us each month as we discuss local issues as they are happening and highlight members of our communities who are seeking better health for themselves and their communities.
I'm Hemen McConan, an incoming fourth-year public policy major with a track in health and population at UCR. I'm also an intern at the UCR School of Medicine Center for Healthy Communities, and I am thrilled to be your host for today. Joining me is Michelle Burrows, Director of UC Riverside Center for Healthy Communities and Public Health Experts, and Dr. Sims, a professor in the UCR's Medical School's Department of Social Medicine, Population, and Public Health. In today's episode, we'll discuss Black health and the different ways we can make strides to end health disparities. It is known that Black people in the U.S. are more likely to suffer from chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, asthma, making their life expectancies much shorter than their white counterparts. According to the CDC, in 2017, the average life expectancy of a Black American is 75.3 years compared to 78.8 years for their white counterparts. The cause for these visible inequities isn't limited to systemic racism and bias in the healthcare and medical treatment, but also to the lack of access to care, information, and socioeconomic differences. Thank you for being here with us today. I'd like to give you the floor to say a few words before we delve deeper into our discussion.
Oh, I just appreciate you having me, Hemen. I am very passionate about public health, and I'm excited to be a part of this podcast.
Thank you for having me, Hemen, and I'm glad to talk about some of my work as far as social determinants of cardiovascular disease, and also get into some of the discussion points about specific groups, their health inequities, disparities here in the Inland Empire, as well as the nation as a whole, particularly marginalized and minoritized groups.
Perfect. Thank you both so much. So, Michelle, you have a remarkable mission to educate marginalized community members to not only take action when it comes to their health, but to also advocate for themselves in the healthcare world. Could you please tell us what health disparities mean to you, especially as it relates to Black health?
Absolutely. I'd be honored to share my perspective on this critical topic. So health disparities represents a deeply entrenched and unjust inequity in access to healthcare, resources, and opportunities that disproportionately affect marginalized communities, specifically the Black community. So when discussing health disparities within the realm of Black health, we're addressing multifaceted issues. It's about acknowledging undeniable reality that Black individuals often face disproportionately higher rates of chronic illnesses, shorter life expectancies, and limited access to quality healthcare services. It also further exacerbates by social determinants of health, such as systemic racism, economic inequality, educational disparities, and unequal distribution of resources. For me, health disparities in Black health represents a systemic failure, a failure of our healthcare system to provide equitable care, a failure of policymakers to address the root cause of these disparities, and also a failure of society to recognize and dismantle the barriers that prevent Black individuals from achieving optimal health outcomes. So I believe it's important to emphasize also that health disparities are not solely due to individual choices or behaviors. A lot of individuals pinpoint people, right? They say it's because you are not conducting yourself in a way that would manifest optimal health, but that's just not the case. There are other things that are rooted in historical injustices, discriminatory practices, and ongoing prejudices that create a complex web of obstacles that disproportionately affect the Black community and also other marginalized communities, which impacts which causes health disparities.
Yeah, no, thank you. Definitely the idea of it being a multifaceted approach is something to take into consideration, as one single approach is not something that could be taken in this regard. So thank you for that answer, Michelle.
Yeah, you definitely have to think about, like I said, like you said, multifaceted. You have to think about all the things that contribute to health disparities. It's just not one sole, you know, issue.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, thank you. So I understand that you were one of the lead organizers in the fourth annual Health Disparities Research Symposium back in February. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to explain the importance of this event? Like, what were the key issues that were discussed, and what initiatives were presented to address equity and access in the inland region?
Absolutely. So the symposium, I was so pleased and so happy to be a part of that. And it served as a platform to bring awareness to pressing health disparities that exist in Southern California, particularly within our inland region. This event aimed to foster a collaborative environment where researchers, health professionals, community leaders, and policymakers could come together and share insights, particularly about our research findings and innovative initiatives that are aimed at addressing health disparities in the Inland Empire. One of the key focal points of the symposium was to address the urgent need or health disparities that affect our community members, specifically our Latinx and other marginalized populations. We discussed issues about healthcare access, quality, and outcomes or health outcomes, which are often, again, rooted in social determinants of health, such as income inequality, education, and housing and environmental factors. And we talked about environmental justice that's emerged as another critical issue that's affecting the Inland Empire, specifically around air quality and how it's impacting our health, like out in the Salton Sea, with a lot of our indigenous communities being impacted by asthma as it relates from, again, harmful particulates that are being emitted out into the air. So we delved into what that looks like as far as the pollution, environmental hazards, and different things that our community members have to encounter or are encountering in the inland, living in the Inland Empire, and how we want to turn things around. We want to create more green spaces. We want to, you know, of course, find interventions and different things that we can do to improve our health outcomes. So I was very excited that we were able to bring all those individuals, different people from different perspectives together to address these concerns. And one of the central symposium goals was to pursue health equity. And what does that look like? So we had two amazing speakers, Dr. Briggs Malison and Dr. Marche Pitt, who helped us understand how to move towards equity and justice. And this involves rectifying the unequal distribution of resources and opportunities that lead to disparate health outcomes. Most of the attendees explored strategies to create a more just and equitable healthcare system that provides everyone with fair access to healthcare quality, regardless of their background or circumstances. So we talked a lot about, and learned amazing speakers, what health equity really looks like and actionable steps that we can take to, you know, move towards a more, what they called, equitable and just society. So one of the noteworthy projects, there were actually many noteworthy projects that were presented at the symposium, but one in particular was addressing the health disparities through virtual care to prevent postpartum depression. And this project brought to the forefront that women of lower socioeconomic statuses and those with lower social support levels are at higher risk of postpartum depression. So these women often go underdiagnosed or untreated due to barriers to their access to healthcare. The group interventions were telephone-based. So they had a peer support group that was telephone-based, and it showed to reduce the risk of postpartum depression by having that social context and that, you know, not them not having to leave their home or try to provide childcare or find childcare, right, while they go to seek some type of individual therapy. They were able to put together a collective group of women over the phone or over Zoom, where they could be there to support one another. So I thought that that was very innovative and a good way to address an issue, you know, as far as postpartum that may not, you know, again, they go untreated and don't really often have the support because of their the limitations that, you know, are there as it relates to access to, you know, behavioral health or mental health services. So I really appreciated one of our presenters being able to share her research study and what she's doing to address an access issue and to also eliminate some barriers to care for women out in the East Coachella Valley.
Wow, that's very interesting. I didn't know about this, and it's that idea that there was a focus group or some sort of like telephone line that was presented for just women in dealing with postpartum depression. And you said that those phone calls or those Zoom calls, were they kind of like a therapy session? Was it kind of like focused around just hearing women out and what they were going through during that period of their lives? How was that really centered?
It was both. It was both just hearing from them, right? Giving them a safe space to be able to share their concerns or their thoughts about what they were going through, you know, post having a baby and what does support look like for them. So it was, you know, multifaceted again. It allowed them a safe space to be able to talk about their concerns and be able to relate to other women and what, you know, they may be going through.
Wow, thank you so much for that, Michelle. What a beautiful project. So turning to you now, Dr. Sims. So Black people in the U.S. are more likely to suffer from chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, asthma, making their life expectancy much shorter than their white counterparts. What do you believe are the key factors contributing to the higher prevalence of chronic conditions among Black individuals in Southern California when we compared them to their white counterparts?
Well, that's a $2 million question there. It's multi-layered, multi-pronged sort of approach to the answer. I think it's shown that not only are behaviors different across ethnic and racial groups that contribute towards the disparities in chronic conditions such as diabetes or hypertension. So behaviors such as, you know, diet, physical inactivity, things like that are associated with higher prevalence of these types of chronic conditions, behaviors such as smoking, alcohol abuse, or consumption. Those all have factors and are associated with higher risk of these types of chronic conditions. But there are also not only these biological risk factors that might impact one's behaviors, you also have social determinants that impact these risk differences across various groups in Southern California area, as well as the nation as a whole. Things like residential segregation, where you live, it shapes your environment, your ability to exercise, to be exposed to safe environments where you can get out and exercise and contribute toward a healthier profile, cardiovascular health. So you have the segregation effect. You have just a number of things that one can trace towards health inequities, things like stress exposures. We see that a higher prevalence in minority populations, higher personal stressors, such as various forms of discrimination. Those are associated with higher risk of chronic diseases among minority populations, which impacts not only one's physical health, but they impact one's mental health. So you have a higher incidence and prevalence of mental or what we call negative affect conditions such as anxiety, depressive symptomatology, and then things like that follow down toward the lower cascade, things like anger, which are then associated with things like one's behaviors. If you feel a certain way, then you're not going to be as likely to engage in certain behaviors, which then contributes toward, you know, higher blood pressure and things like diabetes, and then even obesity, and even the inflammatory path. You have higher levels of C-reactive protein, which are then associated with downstream factors such as heart attacks, angina, chest pain, and then thereby mortality. So you have lower life expectancy. So you see how this cascade occurs from the social determinants exposure to downstream cardiovascular events and different prevalence levels across various groups. So other groups do not experience these types of stressors, negative affect states as readily as other groups do. And even when they do, they have different ways to cope with them. You know, they may have social supports that are in place, access to health care, treatment facilities, and things like that. So you see that there's this difference, even if they do experience some of the same conditions, which are under the rubric of what we call social and psychosocial determinants of health. So that's just a little bit about, provide a little bit of that answer.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that answer. Definitely, it is something to think about. It's not only just a single faceted approach to this question. There's a lot of things that come into it. So it's definitely something that we must keep in mind when we, you know, tackle these type of problems in our community. So thank you for that answer, Dr. Soames. Moving on to our next question. In your opinion, what are the primary barriers that Black individuals in Southern California face when it comes to accessing healthcare services? How do these barriers contribute to the disparities in health outcomes?
Again, involves a multi-pronged approach. It's not a single silver bullet that one prescribes and problems go away. You have to look at structures that have, where these systems are embedded and that produce discriminations and prejudices and things like discrimination and segregation, lower access, lower levels of education, which produce lower levels of income, which produce lower access, which then produces and creates a culture of prejudice in the healthcare treatment arena, where you have discordant and concordant pairs of Black patients versus and a Black doctor, you have a different type of treatment regimen versus a minority patient and a white doctor, particularly male doctors. They may feel and treat you differently, not give you access to proper therapeutics, medications, treatments. And so you have that in the healthcare system that perpetuates inequities, but it's built based on an upstream system of discriminations and inequalities that are built into the systems like the healthcare system, the insurance industry, and just it would even not only the more of the macro level factors, but the individual interpersonal types of factors impact health inequities. Like I explained, the treatment between patient and provider. And also even in these settings, minority patients tend to participate less in their treatment. They're not as engaged with their healthcare providers as are other populations, particularly white populations. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't feel as involved, nor do the provider invites them to be participants in this healthcare exchange as they do other groups. That's what research has shown. So it's not much of my opinion. It's based in what's been demonstrated in the literature and healthcare services research, which shows those types of things. Those are just a few examples of not only my opinion, but based on what does the research bear out as to why these inequities exist in the healthcare services.
To follow up on that, have the research provided any type of solutions as to how we can, as a community or an institution or just like community members in general, how can we build that trust between marginalized people and their healthcare providers so that they're more engaged in their health and take action?
Yeah, I think that programs such as CHC, be engaged with the community, build relationships, and that takes time to gain the trust of a community as one who represents what we call the ivory tower or the academy, because, you know, in the past, relationships have not been good. And even in present day, with many universities and surrounding communities, you know, the citizens the citizens of those immediate communities used to see the academic researchers as doing drive-by research. You know, you collect our data, you collect our blood, you collect our sample. We don't know where you go after that. What do you do? So what? You need to publish these papers. What does that mean for me and my family? What are the actionable steps? that can take place beyond you collecting my data, beyond us inviting you into our homes, to our communities? What are the things that we can take to improve our health? And how are you contributing toward it? A participant may say towards a researcher. So it's those types of things. It's rooted in the historical experiences of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, you know, as to particularly Black populations and other minority populations as well. You know, we've experienced hardships and blatant inequities in the past. So we're not as, quick to, I guess, get on board with certain medical research or certain, you know, CBPR initiatives coming from local universities. So it takes time. It takes time to forge those relationships, particularly, and it's hardest among men, too, because men are rarely involved in studies versus women. In most studies that I've seen it here in Southern California, in studies that I've been a part of around the nation, as well as Mississippi, places in LA. So we have to do a better job of creating that trust and having not only men, but just minoritized populations earn their trust. But not only that, we have to include them at the table where the community are partnering. They're not working for us. We're working together to create solutions, and they have to be equal partners at the table, at the front end of things, not downstream where you created your hypothesis, you created your program, and you try to stick it on the community and say, we have the solution. That's not going to work. I don't care how good your program is. They have to have some weigh-in. They have to have decision-making. They have to have buy-in, and they have to have leadership as well. So that's very, very important. So if you're working from that type of model, which I know Michelle Burroughs and you all in the CHC are working toward that end, and even other researchers around UCR, then you'll have that participation. And then these types of engagements with the community, building the trust, building the efficacy within the community, you're more likely to get them on board with the program, and then you'll more likely see reduce disparities. You're more likely to see favorable health outcomes, not only in participants, but in their children. Because what happens? They spread the word about this program. They spread the word to their children. They have different practices over time. They have better blood pressure, more optimal blood sugar values, which leads to better cardiovascular health. Not even cardiovascular risk anymore, right? Because, I mean, so you see, it amounts to making some easy decisions up front. But for a lot of people, it's really radical because it hasn't been done. So when you do that downstream, you have better outcomes. You have more harmonized community members who are waiting or willing to develop and partner with the university or CHC type centers, and you know, forge ahead to produce better health outcomes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. When you're coming up with a program that's going to be beneficial for a community, it is definitely important to have that community have a say in what that program should look like. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to be benefiting out of it. And also, it's a part of like the ethical considerations too. You know, having a say and having them kind of like lead also the program in a sense where they can feel comfortable to participate and spread the word, just as you said.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, so moving on to our next questions, would you both be able to tell me if there are any specific cultural or historical factors that contribute to health disparities within the Black community in SoCal? And how should these factors be taken into account when developing interventions or policies to reduce these disparities?
So I say one of the key historical factors is the legacy, unfortunately, of systemic racism. That include discriminatory practices like redlining. So I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but you know, when communities are segregated and redlined, oftentimes, specifically Black and Brown communities, they are redlined in areas where there is not adequate housing. The housing is not really, you know, a place where people want to live. There are no green spaces. The educational opportunities are limited or below standard, and there's just not a lot of economic opportunities within their community, right? They have to oftentimes commute far distances to be able to earn a living wage. And these disparities have perpetuated, you know, socioeconomic challenges for communities, which oftentimes, and it has to, there's no way around it, it affects your health outcomes. So this is then turned into mistrust of a healthcare system due to historical and medical mistreatment. You know, we have an example of the Tuskegee syphilis study, which led to hesitancy in seeking care. I think for a lot of, you know, members of the Black community, they felt like that wasn't a trusted space. And a lot, oftentimes people will say, well, that was so many years ago, right? But there have been several examples recently where people have tried to access services and healthcare, and they found that they were oftentimes discriminated against. So developing effective interventions, in my my belief, is it requires policies. You know, really, it's a multifaceted approach. We have to change the policies. Community engagement is vital. I think it's very important to go out and talk to the community and learn from the community what their perspective is on whatever the health issue that you're trying to address. We must involve local leaders and organizations that, you know, can ensure that the interventions that are out there, they're culturally sensitive and tailored to the community's needs. Again, asking the community what their needs are instead of, you know, feeling like we have all of the answers, right? And going out there and putting on to community what we think they need, but asking them what their needs are. And effective educational campaigns that address the historical injustices. You know, we have to acknowledge before we can build trust. You have to go into communities and acknowledge the pain that has happened, whether you agree with it or not. It, you know, you have to acknowledge that all communities of color have experienced some level of injustice as it relates to, you know, accessing care. So we have to acknowledge that to be able to start building trust. And again, you know, just asking them, what can we do different? What can we do better? What things, you know, are currently being done that may be offensive to your cultural practices? And once we do that, then getting to the policymakers, you know, affecting change where we can as it relates to some of these harmful policies that continue to impact people being able to access and receive competent and quality healthcare.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there are structural barriers that are embedded within various communities and cultural practices and attitudes and ideologies that work to create contemporary inequities. And to eliminate, and I think the main one is just structural racism, discrimination. You can't run from that. You can't hide from it. But when you learn to address those and how to address them and come up with viable programs to address them, then you can attract or attack the root causes, because you're getting to the root. You're not hitting at the branch. You're getting to the root to change kind of how people operate, how they think, and then what types of results come about in people's lives. So to eliminate structural discrimination, adverse communities must be transformed, basically. It has to be it's a holistic kind of things. And promoting health in historically marginalized groups and reducing disparities will require restructuring of systems to improve conditions that affect the health of people in workplaces, neighborhoods, schools. So education interventions has been shown that improve education quality to increase things like graduation rates, improve cardiovascular health of children in different stages of a life cycle. Okay, so that's been shown to have complete great efficacy. And then other programs that expand income and employment opportunities that reduce discrimination in the workplace have been shown to result in more favorable health outcomes and movement toward health equity when you have these types of programs. And second, policies to improve also the quality of housing and neighborhood environments have been shown to improve the mental and physical health of individuals, right? And the third thing, future policies must eliminate inequities in access to quality of health care. So, for example, the Affordable Health Care Act, increase the access to insurance and healthcare for historically marginalized groups and underserved groups who lack insurance. But I think more should be done. And when you can like make these interventions more scalable to broader segments of the population, then you see broader changes. You see more impactful changes. Also dismantling structural discrimination. I think that discrimination is predicated on race, and you have to transform people's ideologies and their attitudes, right? So we need to foster allyship between racial and ethnic groups. So Malcolm X said that when the I in illness is replaced with we, then you end up with wellness. And so I think that when you create a sensibility and a sensitivity of people about inequities and inequalities and disparities, then people begin to see the role that they play in either benefiting from the system, or you know, somehow either contributing toward the demise of another group in the system, right? So awareness of inequity should foster change in individual cultural attitudes, right? Political support for change, public empathy for change that needs to occur. All of this contributes to what we call allyship, because it creates a sensitivity in groups who have benefited from the system and say, you know what? If they're not benefiting from this type of system, then we need to call into question the system. We need to change some things. So it not only it puts the onus on minoritized groups to become engaged with help promoting activities, but it behooves those who have been beneficiaries of the community to also make changes. So that's just, you know, part of my two cents on some things that they need to change. And it all stems from what I said originally. I think there needs to be broad community changes on multiple sectors in order to have and realize health equity.
Yeah, I think when you think about it, like you said, like redlining is a big historical factor. If you look at it holistically, you could say that redlining is just about like dividing neighborhoods between like rich and poor. But like you said, it goes deeper than that. It says when it comes to poor, marginalized communities are mainly low income. So they will fall into the place where there's like inadequate housing, therefore like could also affect their health. So it's kind of like interrelated. Nothing is just one, like on one thing.
Absolutely. So even with, you know, as far as access to healthcare, you know, in poor communities, there aren't community clinics. There aren't even hospitals that are within a walking distance or even within, I'd say, a 10, 20 mile radius, right? And oftentimes, if there are, public transportation, it's not, I can say in Southern California, which is what we're talking about, you know, if you're going to take your kids to an appointment, for example, and you live in one of our, you know, our lower economic communities, it's going to take you a couple of hours just to get, you know, you may only be going 10 miles, but if you're waiting on public transportation, right, it's going to take you over an hour to be able to get to that destination. And then you have your appointment, and then you're going to have another hour, right, to get back. And say you've been prescribed medication, and you have to go to a pharmacy. The pharmacy may be another 10 miles out the way, going in the other direction opposite from your house. So, you know, there's so many different factors that go into, you know, somebody receiving quality and competent health care and being able to access it. And we need to start addressing those social ills that have been barriers that have created, you know, this widespread health disparities among communities of color.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And even like in those low income communities, even if there were to be a clinic that was accessible, there is no guarantee that the clinic has the proper infrastructure to adequately tend to their needs. So it's very much an interesting
supplies, right?
Yeah,
a lot of people don't want to come because if it's going to be a community clinic, let's be honest, it's going to be primarily Medi-Cal. The reimbursement rate for Medi-Cal is not great, so it's going to be hard to get really good providers that want to come and work in that clinic. And then two, they're going to be receiving the secondhand or generic version of supplies. So there's so many factors that go into it. And it requires all of us. It requires healthcare professionals, our local policymakers, our legislators, our community leaders to stand up, you know, and really say, this is something that's important to our community and we all need to work in partnership to be able to affect change and increase everyone's health outcomes. Because it's not just about one community, right? If all of us are healthy, if one community is healthy and we're looking at each other as brother and sisters, then all of us will be healthy.
100%. Yeah. Thank you for that insight, mm-hmm. Michelle. Moving on to our next question. Could you discuss any initiatives or strategies that have been implemented or any that you can think should be implemented to address the lack of access to care and information for the Black community? Like, in your opinion, how effective do you think that these interventions have been in reducing health disparities in the past?
Well, just going back to the previous point that I made, some of the sweeping interventions as far as things like education interventions, those are comprehensive interventions because they not only improve one's education quality or increase things like graduation rates, so you're producing more productive citizens that will contribute to our society, then that downstream creates better health outcomes, mental as well as physical. And that then bridges the gap between the health of minority and majority groups. So you have things like that. And those have been shown to be very, very impactful. Also from a housing standpoint, when we are looking at addressing the unhoused population, housing insecurity, housing segregation, when you open up housing and you combat things like residential segregation, racial redlining, you're contributing toward a whole society where health outcomes are going to be better. You know, our research has shown that a lot of projects that I've been a part of have shown that residential segregation increased the risk of heart attacks and incident stroke and heart failure greater than twofold risk. So when people live apart in unequal neighborhoods, in unequal segments of society, then they're not going to be as likely to experience favorable health outcomes, optimal mental health outcomes, and things like that. So housing intervention, things like stipend, I think they call them like stipend type programs, where they're opening up housing to even lower income minority groups. Over time, we're realizing that children of these parents who are able to take advantage of these housing voucher programs have better education outcomes, better mental health outcomes. They concentrate in school more, they have higher grades, they're more likely to go to college, more likely to contribute higher income towards society downstream. So you have just this nice cascade of these increasing elements that flow from opening up housing, you know, as an intervention. So those are the type of what I call more macro level interventions that need to take place. I like the individual interventions as well. But you're not tackling a broader segment of society like you could with more macro level kind of governance or social policy types of interventions. Those are going to be the ones that become more impactful for a broader and a larger group of people, as well as have some sustainability over the life course. They're more likely going to be able to occur and happen in not only in the parents' lives, but then to be translated or transfer or transmit it into the lives of their children, right? So you have this intergenerational cascade that likely impact future mental and physical health outcomes, particularly chronic diseases of folks, children, particularly minoritized populations.
I think there's been a lot of great interventions, honestly, that have that are actively working in the community and that have been implemented. I can tell you about one that we're actively doing. So we're working in partnership with the California Healthcare Foundation, and we have launched a Black Health Equity Initiative. And one of the things that we're doing under that Health Equity Initiative, we're trying to give the community back their power, right? So we're trying to educate them and teaching them ways into how they can access healthcare, how they can take action in doing so, how they can navigate the healthcare system, how they can advocate for themselves and their loved ones. So I think that really effective initiatives, they have to involve the community. They have to have the community's voice. And we have to create an environment where they can come and learn things that, you know, we think maybe are obvious, but, you know, not so obvious. And then there's things that we can do. So I'd say for on our side, we need to learn how to be more culturally competent as providers. And that's all of us, right? What does that look like? It's not, I like to say more culturally humble or have cultural humility instead of being competent, because I really don't think you can ever really be competent in someone and understanding someone's culture, but you can be humble and willing to open yourself up and learn about someone else's culture and how that impacts their health or how they receive healthcare information. So I think that interventions that, you know, on the healthcare side, they're being culturally competent. And then also on the community side, we need to do a lot of work around health literacy. So I think that that needs to be embedded in any type of intervention in the community, really making sure that the education and the materials that you are giving out to the community, that they are receptive, that the community, you know, understands the information that you're trying to communicate and can you go and then use it. You know, it's one thing to be able to understand, but then to be able to apply it. So I think it's really important. And that's the work that we do in our series. We call it How Do I, the How Do I campaign. And it's about teaching and helping folks feel empowered to be able to take action and to be able to advocate for themselves. But they have to be literate. They have to understand, what does that look like? So when I say, how do you navigate the healthcare system? Well, first of all, do you understand how to go about making an appointment? And once you do that, okay, how do I engage my healthcare provider? How can I be prepared, right, to go into the healthcare setting and access healthcare? And also changing people's mindset, helping them realize that healthcare providers are there to serve them. It's a partnership, right? In their journey, they're supposed to work in partnership with you to create or to make sure that you're able to obtain optimal health for whatever that looks like for you, you know, but not to tell you what you should do, you know, for your health to be better, but to ask you and to learn from you, you know, what are you doing? What is your ultimate goal? You know, if you don't already have a chronic illness, these are the things that we can do to create a plan so that you can prevent, right, getting a chronic illness. But we have to, these interventions really have to be actionable, and they have to be delivered in a way that, like I said, our community can receive it and then can actually apply it. Because it's one thing to educate somebody, to give people all this information, and then they go home and they don't remember half of the things that you said. And they don't know what to do with all of the information that you gave them. So I think it's very critical, you know, now when we're going out doing interventions, to make sure that the community understands the information that's being received and they know how to go out and actually apply it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Community interventions, I feel like, is definitely one of the ways you can put a plan forward. When you said that you launched this Black Health Equity Initiative and you're trying to deliver information in a way that is, you know, more receivable by these community members, what has been like the most difficult part in, like, you know, organizing or planning an education system that is receivable?
Wow. Really, I wouldn't consider it difficult. My whole desire is to create safe spaces, because I feel like if you create a space where it's safe for people to come and ask questions, no matter how big or small, you know, oftentimes people will say, well, I was afraid to ask that to my provider because I did not want to look like I wasn't intelligent, right? Or I didn't really talk about what was ailing me at my medical appointment because I didn't want it to come off as I wasn't really concerned about my health. So we need to create safe spaces. I think that's the biggest thing, to build, again, community trust, to create a space where they can come and they can feel free to ask whatever, you know, no question is an unintelligent question, especially when it relates to your health. So just having the space. And I think that we've been successful in doing that and creating those spaces where people come, because we often have folks say stuff, you know, in these sessions where it's even shocking to me. I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty personal information that you share. But I felt happy that they felt like this was a space for them to be able to ask that question that they have, you know, may have wanted to ask their health care provider for quite some time, but were just afraid to do so. So I, like I said, I don't really see any hard challenges in putting these programs or these workshops together. I really enjoy, and I'm always excited, even if, you know, say 50 people register, but only a handful of people show up. I really believe the people that showed up were meant to be there because they needed to hear the information that was provided.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Thank you for that answer, Michelle. Going on to our next question. What role can healthcare providers and institutions play in addressing or mitigating health disparities experienced by Black individuals? Are there any examples of like successful efforts or best practices in this regard?
I think that healthcare providers, the role that they play is critical. And we're talking about not only physicians as healthcare providers, we're talking about nurses, phlebotomists, front desk person. So it's a whole field that needs to become more sensitive to inequities among groups, maybe aware of some of their implicit biases that they have toward groups, which can impact their healthcare experience, be it good or bad, the extent to which they participate in their healthcare. That's important. Ask questions of groups to understand that factors beyond biological risk factors are important in diagnosing physical and mental conditions. So there needs to be more of a holistic approach toward diagnosing health inequities. There needs to be more integration of social determinants of health factors and EHRs, because if you have dashboarding with certain social conditions, then you may get this alert about social risk based on where a person lives, stressors that they answered on a particular questionnaire in the provider's office, so that then they can take more of a holistic approach toward treating their patients versus just this myopic kind of individualistic standpoint of prescribing one therapeutic or one, you know, potential solution. Well, it's a multiplicity of things. So if we integrate a lot of what we do from a social, economic, and psychosocial standpoint into the healthcare model, then we'll be able to pick up more and take more of a universal and holistic approach toward treatment of health inequities, and then lowering health disparities or narrowing the gaps between various groups. We can do that. And I think some of these have been shown to be some of the best practices because it's becoming more universal to include some social determinants of health, you know, neighborhood, environment, degree of stress, degree of anxiety, degree of depressive symptomatology. I think these are becoming more incorporated into the healthcare EHR system to help make diagnosing of conditions. And then it helps to avoid misdiagnosing conditions or even ignoring things that might contribute towards certain behaviors. For example, if you knew a person lived in a food desert, you may be able to speak to them differently versus saying just, well, you got to eat such and such, then you'll have better health. You'll have more favorable health, blood pressure. You'll have more favorable blood sugar. You won't have diabetes. Well, if you can say, well, I can see that you're not, you know, if you saw in the dashboard or even the neighborhood, it may be a neighborhood that does not have access to a gym or educational system or schools are lacking in certain ways, you know, that holistic approach, you'll be able to speak to their full lives rather than one place where the pain is, it may be acute or not. So I think that's just one example. And I think it's shown to be effective, but it needs to be done more widely. We're going to start doing some work on this in the Southern California region to see how efficacious this is in the lives of people. How much does it change as far as the EHR, social determinants of health merging? And
I think it's understanding Black patients' unique needs in the historical context and, you know, their cultural perspectives, and taking the time to improve communication and trust. You know, I know that providers only have 15 minutes or 10 minutes, right, in those appointments. And, but, you know, in the initial appointment, work to understand, you know, here, ask your patient, what is your concern? What did you come in here for today? You know, not what you think you heard, but ask them, what are you here for? What is your main concern? And have a dialogue around that and work to continuously improve communication and investing in diversity within the healthcare workforce can be very impactful. I do believe representation matters, and having Black healthcare professionals can enhance patient-provider rapport and understanding. I think it's important to make sure that you collaborate with community-based organizations. You know, if you are a healthcare provider, you should know about some of the community resources that are available. Because say somebody comes in and they're lacking, you know, they're not eating healthy and they're diabetic. You know, it's one thing to have them schedule an appointment with a registered dietitian, but if they live in a food desert and they don't have access to healthy, nutritious food, then that's an issue right there, right? So kind of like I said, building that rapport, getting to know your patient and understanding what some of the social determinants of health are that are impacting their ability to be able to either be compliant with their medication regime or whatever it is. Make sure that you kind of, like I said, create that space where you understand where your patient is coming from and really be intentional about having open dialogue and communication with them. I think it's also important for us as healthcare providers to understand that, or come from the lens of everybody wants to be healthy, right? Everybody, no one, I don't think, wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? I don't need my health. I don't care about my health. I don't believe that anyone feels that way. So coming from the perspective that, you know, when I engage my patient, you know, they want to be healthy. So what can I do to help facilitate that, right? What information can I provide you with? How can I help you manage, if, like I said, if you already have a chronic illness, how can I help you manage that effectively within the context of whatever you know, you have available to you? But we have to start broadening the scope and asking those questions. Do you have access to nutritious food, right? Do you have access to funds to be able to get your prescriptions if I prescribe you this medication? And yeah, you're not going to have all the answers as a provider. You're not going to be able to address, you know, their economic needs or whatever, but that gives you at least more context that maybe I'll do the generic brand so it'll be cheaper for them, right? Or maybe I can have my, somewhere in the office, we can have a list of community resources where they can go and get, you know, a food basket or something like that. So I just think as providers, we need to work on being, you know, more intentional and really come from a community focus space and treat people like you would want someone to treat your family member if they were going to access healthcare.
Yeah, no, definitely. And to touch upon that first point that you made about establishing communication and trust being pivotal when that first interaction happens, you know, that first interaction, even with a front desk, is very important. If it's negative, it can kind of set the tone throughout the whole, like, checkup session, and the next time they might not even be compelled to come back.
Absolutely. So
it's definitely an important thing to establish within the healthcare system. So thank you for that answer, Michelle. And closing up with our last question. So looking ahead, what are your recommendations for policymakers, healthcare professionals, and community leaders to effectively address and reduce health disparities among the Black population in SoCal?
Well, let's start with policy. Policymakers should really be engaged in developing policies that are anti-discriminatory and really looking, like I said, from a social determinants of health lens. You know, what is going to be the best thing for my community that I'm representing as a whole, right? Do the greatest good with the platform that I have. So I would implore policymakers to really, like I said, look at the health and well-being of their community. They are giving data and stats all the time. So what does that look like? And then try to put into place or change, like I said, practices that you have the platform to be able to do so to improve the health of your constituents. As far as healthcare professionals, again, really be intentional about, you know, participating in cultural humility trainings if they're made available to you. And if they're not, seek them out on your own. You know, you would want to be, I would hope that everyone would want to be the best healthcare professional that they could possibly be, right? And that they would want to engage their patients in a way that they would be happy and fulfilled. And you know that you're doing everything that you possibly can to help people along their health journey in a positive way. So I would encourage all health professionals to really, you know, take an implicit bias test, check your biases. All of us have it. No matter, you know, all of us have some type of bias. And we need to acknowledge that, right? Versus acknowledgement. We need to acknowledge that so then we can move forward and be intentional when maybe that bias is creeping up. Say, no, you know, I am here to serve all people and everyone in the best way that I possibly can. Our community leaders, you know, they are the voice of the community. That's why they're called community leaders. Community will go to them and share their challenges as it relates to health. And I would like them to work in partnership with academic institutions like ours, with other healthcare professionals, you know, work with us, tell us, be the voice of the community, tell us what's going on and how we can partner with you in a meaningful way to bring information to the community, to educate the community, to learn from the community. So those are the things that I would ask that moving forward, that our policymakers, healthcare professionals, and our community leaders would do to start to address, right, and reduce the health disparities among the Black population in Southern California.
To realize that it's not a single sort of, I guess, a silver bullet type approach to getting the answer to the solutions of health disparities. You have to realize it's a multiplicity of factors. Particularly over time, we've ignored social determinants of health. Now that's become more of a sort of a buzzword that people are understanding, but we have to measure things correctly. We can't just throw anything in the pot with social determinants, you know, say, oh, that's it. We are representing the environment by looking at this measure. You know, we can't do that. Also realize that there are mechanisms that need to be better explored. When you're exposed to stress, you know, how to elucidate the pathway between exposure and end-stage sickness. What are some of the pathway kind of factors that we need to unpack? Things like the whole genome sequencing, genetic factors, how are genes altered by the exposure of stressors in the lives of people that downstream impact their prevalence or risk for heart disease, diabetes, incident hypertension, heart failure, coronary artery calcification. Just the list goes on and on and on. So just explore more so that pathway. But also, I think that, you know, I think policymakers and healthcare professionals need to understand, as well as community leaders, need to understand that there's an interaction between even structural discrimination and levels of stress. So we need to be aware that there are interactive effects of these social determinants of health within and among themselves. So for example, a person who reports high levels of discrimination may also report high levels of stress. What does that mean as far as their health outcomes? If they're stressed at a higher level and you're discriminated at a high level, then you may likely, you know, be angry at a high level, anxious at a high level. To what extent does that accumulation of social risk have on your health, right? We can't study things in isolation. We have to bring things together and understand the cumulative nature, because real life occurs simultaneously. You know, we don't experience discrimination and then later on we're depressed. No, that depression may come as a result of discrimination. So how do they pair together or jointly impact your health? That's very important. That's been ignored. So we need to really look at that as well. I think as policymakers can look at exploring the need to address, you know, anxiety as well as structural improvements and systems simultaneously to then to ward off or mitigate the negative impacts of these factors downstream with things like, you know, chronic disease, disparities and things like that. So
yeah, I definitely agree. The fact that there's an interaction between the social determinants of health and just all of these different external stressors that also apply into our health is definitely important to understand and also keep in mind as, you know, we go forward into trying and implementing a better health outcomes for the Black community. So definitely it is something that I as well will keep in mind as I work on my journey in public health. So thank you so much for that insight.
All right, well, that concludes our episode on the topic of Black health disparities in Southern California. Michelle and Dr. Sims, I just want to express my gratitude for your invaluable insights and expertise on this topic. Your deep understanding of the complex factors contributing to these inequities and your commitment to addressing them is truly commendable. So I know that all your words today has inspired me as a young public health scholar to make some sort of change within my community, and I hope it does the same to our listeners. And I hope also that your insights will undoubtedly inspire policymakers, healthcare professionals, and community leaders to take meaningful action towards reducing health disparities and promoting health equity. So any last words before we close off?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak on this topic. It's near and dear to my heart. I am a Black, you know, woman, and I know that we were definitely disproportionately affected during COVID, and that's what kind of, you know, really made me want to be more intentional, specifically as it relates to the Black community, to start having these conversations, right, with our community members and with other healthcare professionals, as well, to say, how can we change this narrative around? I don't want another pandemic or any other major thing to happen where, you know, we see the headline disproportionately affected and it always has Black community after it. I want to change that narrative. And I believe that if we all work together, we can and we will, you know, improve our health outcomes for not only the Black community, but for all communities. So thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Healthy Disruptions, and a special thanks to Belzar Music for the making of our intro and outro music.
This podcast was produced by the Community Engagement and Dissemination Corps of the Center for Health Disparities Research in collaboration with the Center for Healthy Communities at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine. This episode's content was developed by our team.
For more information and the show notes for this episode, you can also visit our website at healthydisruptions.buzzsprout.com.
And we'll see you next time for some more Healthy Disruptions.